Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome to Rex Factor. This week, Isabella of France. Review
with your hosts Graham Duke and Ali Hood.
Hello,
and welcome to Rex Factor, reviewing all the Queen and Prince consorts of England, from Elswith to Prince Philip. And today we are reviewing Isabella of France, Queen Consort of Edward II. Last time we did her biography episode, so today we're going to review her and decide whether or not she deserves the Rex Factor.
Yeah, and I'm sure everyone is terrifically excited about this.
If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can find us on Twitter and Instagram, where we are at Rex Factor Pod. Like the Rex Factor Podcast Facebook page and email us at rexfactorpodcast@hotmail.com. And we're a free podcast, but if you'd like to hear more of us, then you can donate monthly, join the Privy Council and get lots of bonus content and episodes by going to www.patreon.com/Rex Factor.
Yeah.
Now, before we review Isabella, we're just going to have a quick recap on her life story.
Biography.
So Isabella of France was born in 1295, the daughter of two monarchs, Philip IV of France and Joan I of Navarre. She married Edward II of England in 1308, and this was very much a marriage of ups and downs. It got off to a bad start when Edward was showing undue favour to his possible lover, Piers Gaveston. But following an intervention from her father, Isabella was then treated with greater respect and seems to have accepted Gaveston. The nobles of England, however, did not. So in 1313, Gaveston was murdered by the Earl of Lancaster, who is Isabella's half-uncle and the most powerful noble in the land. Isabella supported Edward in the ensuing struggle and grew much closer to him in the process. But after Lancaster's defeat and death in 1321, Edward's new favourite, Hugh Despenser the Younger, worked to ostracise Isabella, resulting in the breakdown of her relationship with Edward. She's sent to secure a truce with France in 1325, and she becomes a beacon for those who are opposed to this Despenser regime, and she launches an invasion of England in 1326, supported by Roger Mortimer, possibly her lover. She deposes, if not murders, Edward II and replaces him as king with her son, Edward III. And because he's young when he becomes king, for a time, Isabella and Mortimer rule the country as pseudo-regents, but they unfortunately prove rather unpopular and end up being overthrown by Edward III, who executes Mortimer. But Isabella largely becomes a very conventional queen mother after this, and she's still involved in Anglo-French diplomacy and a regular face at court until her death in 1358 at the age of 63.
Wow. I can see why that was a whole episode.
Yeah. But how will she do when we review her?
Battliness!
So for battliness with the consorts, we're looking for agency, independence of action, some fighting spirit. As a bonus, any involvement in military affairs is obviously a big plus. And I think it's fair to say Isabella somewhat delivers on all of that.
Yeah. And in spades. But what about the military bit? Any military-ness?
Well, I mean, we will get to the thing that obviously everybody's thinking of, which is when she invades England.
Oh.
Which is quite military.
Oh, yeah.
As these things go.
God, I didn't even... That's so big, it bypassed me. That wasn't just her coming back. Yeah. So that must have been with an army.
Yes.
Wow. This is going to be really good, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. So that's the biggie, which obviously everybody apart from you has been expecting we're going to talk about. But she shows some fighting spirit before relations with Edward began to sour. She accompanied him on his campaigns against Scotland, and on two occasions was forced to make dramatic escapes. to avoid capture. So she does end up rather in the firing line, perhaps more Edward's fault rather than because she was trying to be on the firing line. But still, she's there and has to escape. In 1321, she played a supporting role in Edward's conflict against the nobles in what was known as the Despenser Wars. So Edward was looking for a casus belli against his enemies, and Isabella helped provide it for him at Elise Castle when she deliberately requested entry to the castle, knowing that it was owned by a rebel baron. So ostensibly she needed somewhere to stay whilst on pilgrimage to Canterbury, but in reality it was probably to provoke a conflict.
What was that cheeky bit of Latin?
Casus belli.
Yeah.
It's a just cause for war.
Definitely thought it was, it sounded like an Italian restaurant, yeah.
Yeah.
The belly house. The best pizzas in town.
So Isabella knocks on the door and says, "I demand you let me in, I'm the queen." They say no. Isabella tells her men to force their way in. And the castle opens fire. Six of her men are killed in the process.
I can't believe they did that.
Yeah.
I mean, even though they knew that she was looking for a big fat belly, they knew that she was looking for a big fat belly and shouldn't have fallen for the trap.
Yeah. It was a bad move because it gives Edward an excuse to take the strategically important castle. It brings moderate nobles onto Edward's side because of the dishonour shown against Isabella. So if it had been against him or if it had been against the Despensers, people might not have cared. But because it's against the Queen, people think, oh, this is taking it too far.
Yeah.
Edward does very well in this war. He enforces the surrender of Roger Mortimer and various other nobles that are against him and then pushes north. Whilst he goes north, Isabella is given custody of the Tower of London and indeed the Great Seal of the Kingdom. And from there, she orders provisions to be sent to York and Carlisle castles, sends messages to the sheriffs in the north to come south to prevent the Earl of Lancaster escaping to Scotland. And as a result of this, they do indeed cut him off, and he is outnumbered and defeated in battle.
All right. Lancaster no more, yeah.
Indeed.
Her uncle.
Yes. However, the main success for Isabella in battling this was her invasion of England in 1326, which, as you've now realised, is quite a military cup of tea.
It's a very punchy cup of tea. Can we call this a French invasion?
No, not really, because technically she gets her troops and ships from Hainaut. So it's sort of a Dutch invasion, led by a French woman.
Yeah, I mean, okay, it's multinational.
Yeah.
It's a coalition. Why isn't this bigger? Because it was done by a queen? If that were a man, that would have been a successful invasion. I mean, it was a successful invasion, but it would have been lauded as so. Or am I just not reading the right books or something?
Why have I forgotten about this? What
basically?
What happened that meant that I didn't clock that this is a thing that happened?
Can we blame TV production companies for not putting this into my brain?
Well, yes, we can do that. We have not seen enough of this. A lot of the early work was diplomatic, so securing the support of disaffected English nobles, both those who are in Paris but also those who are still in England. She takes advantage of the fact that she's got security by being based at her brother Charles IV's court in Paris.
Mm.
So she's not reachable by Edward at this point. And she acquires an army through a marriage alliance with the Count of Hainaut. She also contacted Scotland and Robert the Bruce, and the Scots agree not to cause any trouble while she's invading.
Why not? That would be ideal.
Well, because they think, oh, this is good, she'll get rid of Edward. And presumably she makes some kind of promise to them about her future policy towards Scotland.
Oh man, I'd have definitely said, can you go and cause a load of trouble so that he has to send some troops up there?
Well, no, the issue is that I guess that Isabella would have to go and send some troops up there. Or indeed, if the Scots invade, then nobles who might support Isabella will be like, well, we can't focus on that. We've got to deal with the Scots.
Yes, okay. Good, so it's all set.
Yeah. It's good that Isabella was in charge of the diplomacy on this one, I think.
She's definitely, yeah she's...
So with all this support behind her, it might be surprising that the actual invasion force was rather small, probably only numbered something like 1,500 soldiers.
Oh, that's probably why I haven't heard of it, because it wasn't a massive ship crossing.
Hmm. But counterintuitively, this is reflective of how strong Isabella's position was.
Oh, yeah.
Because Edward realises this, so when he hears that she's landed with such a small force, he declares, "Alas, alas, we be all betrayed. For certain, with so little power, she had never come to land, but folk of this country have to her consented."
Yeah. It's almost showing off, isn't it?
So Edward ordered a force of 2,000 soldiers to go to intercept her at Orwell, but only 55 actually went.
Oh, they landed at Orwell, didn't they?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I should have heard of this. I feel like that's a bit like my manor, that one.
Mm.
That's my area. Why haven't I seen a laminated board?
Should be a plaque floating somewhere. Yeah. So Edward's support in the country quickly melts away, partly due to his unpopularity, but also thanks to Isabella's mastery in manipulating public opinion. In Paris, she declared she would wear the black mourning robes of a widow until the dispensers had been expelled. And that's exactly what she did, not just in France, but as she progressed through England. She's on horseback in black, you know, with the veil over her eyes. So she simultaneously manages to lead a coup against her husband and gain universal sympathy as the wronged wife.
Wow. Gosh, she's a clever stick, isn't she?
And she cemented her victory in the propaganda war by issuing a proclamation declaring that the church and country was much tarnished and degraded by the bad advice and conspiracy of Hugh de Spencer. And she pledged that she would safeguard and maintain, so far as we can, the honour and profit of the Holy Church and of our said Lord the King and the whole kingdom, and called on the people of England to come to our help well and loyally whenever the time and place are right and by whatever means lie within your power. And the final stroke of PR genius is that she fixes the original of this proclamation onto the Eleanor Cross at Cheapside, a highly symbolic site for queenship, and shows that she's effectively claiming the inheritance of Edward I and Eleanor of Castile.
Oh, right. Yeah, of course, Edward's first wife.
And so, Edward II's mother.
Oh, yeah. So she's sort of doing an official channel. She's saying, look, this is absolutely legitimate.
Yeah.
She's good. Who invented PR then? Was she before?
That was William III, 400 years later.
Oh, so she invented PR?
One of many.
Okay.
Most importantly, of course, with the invasion, it was successful.
Yeah, good.
Edward abandoned London, town after town, welcomes Isabella without resistance. The elder Hugh de Spencer was successfully besieged at Bristol Castle. And then Edward II and Hugh de Spencer the Younger are captured. This is the first successful invasion of England since 1066, as well as the first time a sovereign had been deposed since 1066.
Well, yeah, this is huge. I don't understand why this... Because that's a fact that is often bandied about, that England hasn't been successfully invaded for nearly 1,000 years.
Mm.
Nonsense.
I guess the issue is that she's the Queen of England, and with her is the son and heir of the King in England. So it goes Edward II, his son and heir. So it's not like another country has come over and changed everything. Yeah. Right now the Germans are in control, now the French are in control. It's actually the rightful line of succession. It just happens a bit earlier than Edward II might have expected. Eleanor of Aquitaine was connected with a rebellion against Henry II, but that was unsuccessful. So Isabella is the only queen in English history to dethrone her own husband and to take control of the country in such dramatic fashion.
Wow. Oh, good for her. That is brilliant.
A final point in her favour on battliness is the Hundred Years' War.
Hmm?
So following the death of Isabella's three brothers without male heirs, her son, Edward III, is Philip IV's only... Well, actually, she's got two sons, but we'll forget about the younger one. Philip IV's only grandson and his closest living relative after Isabella herself. So when the French throne goes from her last brother to her cousin, Isabella publicly pursues Edward's claim to the French throne. Because by primogeniture, he is closer in line than the cousin.
The cousin. Mm. But the cousin's a fella.
Cousin is a fella.
Then it's tenuous, isn't it? I mean, not that I'm agreeing with it, but back in the day.
Well, they didn't. Salic law hadn't quite been formally instituted at this point. It's kind of now that they try to do it. It was more that there just hadn't been a precedent where the male line extinguishes in that way, but that you do have a grandson via a daughter.
It's a good argument.
Mm. So Isabella is the one that first makes this claim. I imagine you would think that she really instills in Edward III a belief that he has a rightful claim to the French throne. And he does obviously later go on to make that claim very forcefully. And as such, this inspires some of England's most successful military campaigns, with Edward III enjoying some astonishing victories against the French and effectively restoring the old Angevin Empire.
Crikey. How long ago was that Angevin Empire now?
So it all ends with John. So that's, 1250. So it's 100 years.
And it still then goes back to Eleanor. All roads lead to mamas.
All goes back to Eleanor, but 100 Years' War and all of those victories ultimately come because of Isabella.
Yeah. She's brilliant. I mean, she's very much like Eleanor.
Mm.
Any relation?
Yes. Yes.
I mean, yes is always the answer.
Impressive as an invasion and deposition is, however, it's a bit disappointing that there are no actual battles to speak of.
Yes. Yeah.
So maybe that's why it's not quite in your imagination so much, because apart from besieging Bristol Castle, it's basically a procession ending with Edward's capture, because everybody just opens the door and lets her in.
Because everyone hates these dispensers a lot.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, being so successful you don't actually have to fight is impressive in itself.
Mm.
But an actual battle would have been good.
Yeah, it's being too strong. It's like when aeroplanes start to lose their armaments, or bombers lose their armaments because they're, you know, useless now. You can go too fast, too high, or whatever. And you're like, yeah. Be good if it was a bit more fair fight, and you could do more intricate modelling.
It's the Edgar the Peaceable problem.
Yeah. True. Huh.
But there's also a leadership question in battliness. While Isabella is undoubtedly the key figurehead, some might argue perhaps could Roger Mort have been more important as the actual leader of this whole shebang. He'd been gathering support in Europe 2 years before Isabella came to France. He laid the groundwork for the Hainault Alliance before Isabella formalised arrangements. So is it really his victory in a way rather than Isabella's?
No. He couldn't have done it without her, and she had enough going on that she would have known. She could have stopped it. I mean, chose not to. She's just using her allies wisely.
And technically, it doesn't really matter, does it? Because it makes sense for her to have an experienced soldier who's maybe making strategic calls, like
quite
a general.
Right.
That's what you'd expect of a king. Not all kings are great military leaders, but you'd expect them to have people that are.
Yeah, exactly.
Hmm. Now, once Isabella had control of the levers of power, she didn't provide the martial leadership that the nobles had craved, and makes humiliating and unpopular peace treaties with France and Scotland. So with France, much of Gascony is returned to England, but at a cost of 50,000 marks, and they lose the territory of the Agenais, which is a region that Edward II had demanded back, and was kind of the whole issue with why she was in France in the first place.
Mm.
And while Isabella claims Edward's right to the French throne in theory, the reality was that she was in no position to take any positive actions, and France at this point was still chipping away at England's ambitions in France.
So this is putting to bed these unpopular treaties with France and Scotland and stuff. It's putting to bed the Edward the First, who's going to rule Scotland issue.
Yeah, so the Scottish one is the one that's particularly unpopular. So border raids resumed in 1328 after the Scots had initially sort of kept out of the way. Mortimer was unable to force the Scots into open battle, and then the Scots raided the English camp and collapsed Edward III's tent on top of him. So the Treaty of Edinburgh and Northampton recognised Scottish independence, restored the borders as they were back in the day. So for all Edward II's humiliations against Scots, he'd never abandoned the claim that England had over Scotland. But now Isabella has basically said, yeah, draw a line under that. You win, we lost. Let's move on.
I think, though, that's still Edward's fault that she's forced to do that because of his ineptitude.
Mm.
Yeah, I think that's fine. I mean, this is all her doing, isn't it? This is her. She's making these sort of kingly decisions.
And the final thing against her in battliness is the fact that, having deposed Edward II, Isabella and Mortimer are themselves deposed by Edward III. And obviously, technically, it's her own son and the actual king so you might not see it as a significant military defeat, but it's still worth acknowledging the fact that she lost power against her will.
Yeah, I think actually it is significant, isn't it? Because if we're saying that the invasion wasn't a significant military invasion, it was, you know, was actually significant. The overthrow of that is significant as well. Hmm. I mean, it's really out of the frying pan into the fire for these poor old nobles who go from the McKinley. What was it? What was the second lot of Edward's lovers called? The
Despensers.
Despensers. Who's McKinley?
He was an American president that was assassinated.
Yeah, well,
later. I
mean, exactly. As you know, that is relevant later. But in the meantime, the Despensers and then the Mortimers. So that's a real failing from Isabella, that she can't recognise that she's committing the same mistake that gained her the support.
Possibly, we might find maybe that will be more pertinent for subjectivity.
Yeah, that's true.
And it's still, even though it is kind of similar to her own invasion, I guess it is still different that Edward III was the king, and then effectively his coup was to say, no, I really am the king.
Yeah, because her coup was to say that he's the king.
Hmm.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, I see what you're saying. Sorry, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's what she ultimately wanted anyway.
Mm.
Yeah,
so as defeats go, having your beloved son fully in control of government isn't the worst defeat.
Yeah, when you say, but imagine. Edward, I want you to be fully in control. Yes, that's what's happening here.
I just don't want this weird guy in Dad's bed anymore.
Yeah. He's looking at me funny and telling me I can't play tennis. well, it's very good, isn't it? Have we got more?
No, that's my, yeah, that's my full.
I am looking for reasons not to give her a big old 10.
So the highest score we've had thus far was Eleanor of Aquitaine with 19.5. You gave her a 10, I gave her a 9.5. And I gave her a 9.5 because I thought, you know, she has that sort of rebellion against Henry, but it's very unsuccessful. And I was thinking there definitely is a way that it could be better than what Eleanor managed. Mm. And I was thinking of Isabella.
If you were to take a 0.5 off, it would be for the very end where she takes her off the ball and Mortimer is the same problem.
But I feel that's more subjectivity than this battle is,
yeah,
really.
Yeah, yeah, it is. It's just someone speeding up her timetable, actually.
Mm. Agency, independence of action, that's all there. Actually invading the country, deposing the king, first time since 1066.
All right, I'm now looking ways to give her 10 when I think actually it just is a 10.
I think it's got to be a 10. I mean, I can't really expect anything more than that.
That's brilliant. 10.
That is the first of this series, 20 out of 20 for battliness.
Scandal.
I think it's fair to say Isabella's got a pretty decent chance of scoring well here as well.
Yeah, I've been so focused. I don't know what I've been focused on, not much in particular, but this is all scandalous as well, isn't it?
Yeah. Do you have your bell?
I do, yeah. Yeah, it's been sitting ready.
Before we get to some of the big obvious stuff, even though she didn't give Edward II or his chroniclers any initial cause for concern on the scandalous front, she did play a central role in one of the most notorious scandals of the age, the Tour de Nail affair. This was in France. So in 1313, Edward and Isabella went to France for chivalric celebrations with the knighting of Isabella's three brothers. And her brothers are all married to daughters of the Duke of Burgundy. Now, after watching a satirical puppet show, Isabella gave two of her sisters-in-law embroidered purses. But later that year, back in England, she noticed two Norman knights carrying the purses that she had given as gifts. So she's a bit suspicious. And when she returns to France in 1314 as part of another diplomatic mission, she tells her father of her concerns. And after secret investigations, all three of her sisters-in-law are arrested on charges of adultery, thrown into the dungeon at Chateau Gaillard, and two of them are actually found guilty.
Oh, we did this, didn't we, on the Chateau Gaillard one?
The scandal rocks France, seriously affected the standing of women at the court, while in one fell swoop, the marriages of all three of her brothers were either undone or undermined in the public eye. So, you know, if you're being conspiracy theorist about this, is it too far-fetched to suggest that Isabella's got her eye on the French throne? Because obviously at that point, Edward III is the only heir for Philip IV, because she's wiped out the three marriages of her brothers.
Oh. I wouldn't put it past her.
Now, against this, obviously you'd point out to the fact that they're all very young and they could just marry somebody else and have more children.
Yeah, but it's nice, a nice bit of grey area that she's building in there.
She's not one who is above a little plotting.
Yeah.
Much more direct, of course, is that Isabella led an invasion of England against her husband, the king, and had him overthrown. Now, we won't go into all the details again, but there was a bit of added spice to some of the alliances that she created, because the Count of Hainaut, who provided all of the ships and the troops, was actually at odds with Edward II at this point. But that was nothing to the fact that Isabella made overtures to Robert the Bruce, and probably offered to recognise Scottish independence in return for Scotland giving her a free run during the invasion. So, prior to Isabella, Robert the Bruce, very much the bête noire of Edward's entire reign.
Now he's got his wife to contend with as well, and she's making a pact with him.
The real spice, however, with all of this, is that she was in close alliance with her husband's most notorious English enemy, Roger Mortimer. So he, as we said, had been captured in those Despenser Wars in 1321, but he then escaped from the Tower of London and has spent the next few years plotting to murder Edward and the Despensers. Not only does she ally with his enemy, but she almost certainly has an affair with him.
Now, was he too devilishly good-looking to put down, or do you think this was a bit of a needle as well? I mean, probably a bit of both.
Well, I mean, I'm sure there's a bit of frisson that it is as forbidden as it could possibly have been. Fact that he's an enemy, the fact that they're both sort of at odds. They've obviously got a common cause against Edward and the Despensers. They're of a similar age. Ian Mortimer's described it as one of the great romances in the Middle Ages. He is a sort of successful and daring soldier. Isabella is beautiful, intelligent, and is presenting this chivalric allure dressed in her widow's garbs. And they share a love of Arthurian romances, and it almost feels like they're playing out the Guinevere Lancelot legend.
Yeah, he's got the leading man in a Hollywood film thing wrapped up.
There's some historians have suggested that they were actually having an affair even before all of this, earlier in the 1320s. And some even suggest Isabella might have had a hand in helping him to escape from the Tower of London. But there's no actual evidence for this. And it's thought most likely that it is when he comes to Paris in 1325 that they get introduced and form a close alliance. Now, a queen committing adultery is about as scandalous as it can get, really. And obviously, Isabella has seen the consequences, what with the Tordonelle affair and what happened to her sisters-in-law. Yeah. And it could have completely undermined her cause. Remember that she's posing as the poor queen, the wronged woman, etc., etc. And then if she's now seen to be having an affair with this notorious exile, that could blow the whole thing.
Crikey. What's she thinking?
And it does seem that discovery of their affair was the reason why some of Isabella's household actually chose to return to England from Paris in 1326.
Oh.
So they were obviously irked by it, but otherwise they must have been sufficiently discreet, because they don't face any public censure, and chroniclers only really hint at it with comments such as, "Mortimer secretly came first in the private household of the Queen."
Ooh.
But this had been of little comfort to Edward II, who does seem to have been aware, and he is not so reticent in a letter that he sends to his son. "She openly, notoriously attached to herself the Mortimer, our traitor and mortal foe, and she accompanies him in the house and abroad."
Oh, good Lord.
Now, as an extra bit of frisson, 1330, so this is just before the fall of their regime, the rumours circulate that Isabella was pregnant with Mortimer's child.
Mm.
And with Mortimer holding himself in an increasingly regal fashion, this could have represented quite a threat to Edward, because you think if Mortimer's thinking, you know what, I might as well just keep on being in charge.
Oh, yeah. And have a...
has a child by Isabella, who's the Queen of France and the Queen of England. He might think, well, you know, I've got myself a bit of a dynasty going on here.
Yeah. What happens?
Well, there's no evidence for a child being born. So if there was any truth in it, the child was either given away at birth or didn't survive to term.
Yeah, that can't be true.
I think it's based on the fact that there were contemporary rumours and that she has an unusually long stay at Kenilworth at one point.
I'm really sorry. I've woken up in a peculiar mood. Everything sounds like innuendo.
What was the innuendo there? Yeah,
well, the rumours abounded because she had a particularly long stay at Kenilworth, if you know what I mean. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Well, I'm going to use it now. Looks like she's having... Yeah, it's like someone's about to go off for a long stay at Kenilworth.
So, Not only did Isabella ally with two of England's enemies, not only did she ally with Edward's most notorious enemy and take him as her lover, not only did she invade the country and depose her husband, but she potentially commits regicide.
She is doing everything she can for this score. If you start saying it was on the way to a nunnery, I'm going to burst.
So after three attempts to rescue Edward from captivity had been discovered, it probably seems likely at this point they thought it's too risky to let him keep on living. So initially it was simply stated that he had died conveniently of natural causes, but by 1330 it's been stated on record that he'd been murdered at Berkeley Castle. Most accounts of his murder state that he'd been strangled or suffocated, but over time, the rather gruesome detail is added that he'd been killed by the insertion of a red-hot poker into an area where one would rather not receive a red-hot poker. Although, to be fair, that's pretty much everywhere. But.
He died by red-hot poker. Do you need to know where? Not really. wow. Gross.
Now, against her, again, we have to ask, was Isabella's invasion truly a sort of Machiavellian master plan? So Helen Castor suggested, well, she states that Isabella had been waiting for her chance, and it's with the connivance of her brother that she finds an excuse first to get herself and then to get her son out of the country so that she's then able to make that invasion and overthrow Edward. But probably more likely that it's all sort of, to quote The Simpsons, just a bunch of stuff that happened.
Yeah.
The idea of sending Edward III to pay homage in place of Edward II had actually been mooted by the English originally before Isabella ever went to France. Mm. So if this was all a French master plan to get Edward III to the country, then it's something that actually Edward II would have just suggested himself anyway.
Right, yeah.
And Isabella's correspondence suggests that she really was trying to secure peace with France in 1325 and that she was expecting and possibly hoping that Edward II would have come in person to join her to perform homage. And obviously, if he had gone in person, everything would have been very different.
We wouldn't have met Mortimer.
Because then he would have been in France with her. She would presumably have come back with him. She may have been able to say to him, look, while I've got you, let's really have a proper chat about this Despenser lot.
Yeah. Yeah. And sort it all out.
And obviously she still does the invasion and the coup, but I guess it's maybe that the plotting is maybe a bit more reactive than that she's sitting at home years earlier going,
yeah, that's all right though. You know, that because plans change as soon as you implement them and all that. She's got to be flexible. I think it should have done much worse if it was one of those cases of sitting back on her own in prison for years planning a Bane-style thing where everything is planned to the opening of a door at the exact right time, blah, blah, blah. This is just actually how things unfold.
Another big question is whether she's really guilty of regicide. So many historians think it's more likely that Mortimer is responsible for this. So the two men who were later blamed for Edward's murder were associates of Mortimer. And interestingly, Isabella made a request after Edward's death to meet with his embalmer, which perhaps suggests that she's got some concerns about what happened to him and that maybe she wants to know, did he really die of natural causes or could it have been foul play, which sort of suggests that perhaps she didn't know what had happened.
Excuse me, sir. Let me see the royal bottom. but I can't believe Mortimer could have done it without her knowing. Or were relationships really not that close in those days?
Well, I mean, I think it's just the fact that, you know, it's his men that have got Edward in custody. So he doesn't, it's quite easy for him just to say, you chaps, hop over, guard knows what's going on, just, you know.
Doing one, yeah.
Deal with it. Of course, if even it was Mortimer, you can still argue, it's similar to Richard III, when people say about if the prince is in the tower, if he didn't make the order, you've still got the argument that it's under her watch and it's under her regime. So there's an element of responsibility there, even if she doesn't actually give the order.
I haven't heard anything that, well, maybe the embalmer.
There are also historians who speculate that Edward II didn't die at all and that he actually escaped captivity and survived, meaning Isabella couldn't have committed regicide because he wasn't dead.
Nonsense.
There is evidence. There's definitely enough for it to be a point of debate, though you could argue that if he is escaping an attempted regicide, even if he wasn't killed, Isabella would still be guilty of attempted murder of her husband, the king.
Yeah.
Even if he did get away.
I mean, she's whatever happened. He's dead in public,
and that's scandal.
Well, that's got to be 10.
Yeah, I mean, we've got overthrowing a husband, an invasion, allying with his enemies, taking a lover who is another one of his enemies.
It's brilliant. She can't. Well, she could, but unlikely that she would have the whole sex with nun things. And if she did, clearly that would just be absolutely off the scale. Failing that, she has topped every category. It's a big fat belly 10.
It's a 10 for me as well. That's 20 out of 20 for scandal. And I think that this is the first time ever that we've had two 20s for one person.
Yeah, really?
So she's currently 40 out of 40. Anyway, that is all looking pretty impressive thus far. We'll see if she can keep that going with subjectivity after a short break.
Subjectivity.
Now, this might be a less obvious source of strength for Isabella, but before everything goes south, she was a very conventional and effective consort.
Yeah.
She collected more than 30 volumes of books with a mix of religious works, romances, particularly Arthurian legends, collected painted panels of Lombard works, employed a minstrel called Walter.
It's not funny, the name Walter. I don't know why that's funny.
And yet I knew to leave it in.
Yeah, I guess this is all part of her understanding of queenship, isn't it? She would see this as an integral part of being a good queen.
Yeah, she loves luxury items like jewellery, fine clothing and wine, but she also grows increasingly pious in later ages. She goes on numerous pilgrimages, and she does, like many queens before her, enjoy collecting relics.
Yeah.
Most notable in her collection is a ring belonging to a much-loved English saint and archbishop.
No. Really?
Dunstan.
I mean, that's possible, isn't it?
But I just thought you'd like the image of the fact that when she's doing all of this cool stuff, she is potentially going around with Dunstan's ring.
Dunstan's ring and a minstrel dressed all in black on that, like, some sort of death metal fan, and the minstrel's got an electrified lute playing War Pigs by Black Sabbath.
That wasn't where I was expecting this to go when I said Dunstan, but nevertheless. As queen, Isabella was noted for her kindness. In 1312, she arranged for a young Scottish orphan to be fed and clothed and later had him brought to London for his education. While in 1314, she bought clothes for three knights who'd lost everything after fleeing the Battle of Bannockburn.
Oh, that's good of her.
As Queen Dowager, she was very active in charitable work. She maintained a number of poor scholars at Oxford and distributed alms to paupers throughout the year. And after the capture of Edward II, she apparently continued to send him clothes and gifts and was said to have wanted to go and visit him, but was prevented by doing so by some of the bishops who feared for her safety.
Yeah, that was that's surprising.
Being cynical, you might wonder whether she just made a show of wanting to go and visit him and send gifts so that she could maintain the fiction of being a good wife while she was actually overthrowing him and taking a lover.
Yeah, that's more likely, isn't it? And more sort of in her wheelhouse.
Yeah. Although things didn't get off to a good start when she first came to England, Isabella does prove an effective queen once she develops a better relationship with Edward. She has particular success as a peacemaker between Edward and the nobles. In 1313 and 1318, she publicly interceded to avoid conflict between Edward and the Earl of Lancaster. And in 1321, the Annals of St. Paul's described how she helped to convince Edward to exile the Despensers to prevent another civil war. Even the Lady Isabella, Queen of England, bowing on her knee, interceded for the common people, telling the king about the petitions of the lords and barons.
Yeah, she sounds like an all-round good egg. Hmm. She didn't have to do this, or rather the king didn't have to trust her to have anything to do with diplomacy. Hmm.
And Eleanor of Provence, and particularly Eleanor of Castile, really didn't show any interest in this sort of intercession. They were very much just, you know, whatever the king does, who cares? So Isabella is more of a peacemaker than some of her immediate predecessors.
Yeah.
Obviously, yeah. Up until the point that she invades. Much less common for English queens is a significant role in international diplomacy, but as the daughter and then sister of the kings of France, Isabella can play this sort of informal role, utilising her personal connections in a way that's not open to any of the nobles or the bishops.
Yeah, Yeah, she's well connected.
Mm. She goes to Paris in 1314 on her own, and then with Edward in 1320, where she helps to suppress problems in the town of Abbeville in Ponthieu, where she's a countess. So she helps to negotiate the city's return after her brother had taken control of it. She also did negotiate terms with France in 1325 that did, you know, bring out a peace treaty. Edward doesn't like the terms, but he does agree to them. And the fact that he sends her at all when she was very much on the fringes of court at this time indicates how she really does act as a diplomatic asset in Anglo-French relations.
Yeah, yeah. She is. I mean, it's not just her connections, is it? She could still be a puppet and someone go out there with her and say, the Queen thinks this, this, this. She's, her intelligence is recognised.
Yeah. And this continued as Queen Dowager. So after the Black Prince captured, so this is the eldest son of Edward III, so her grandson. After the Black Prince captured King Jean II of France in 1356, he spends the next few years as an honoured prisoner in England. And Isabella, of course, as the Frenchwoman at the English court, helps to entertain him and his noble household, lends him two copies of Arthurian romances, The Holy Grail and Sir Lancelot, dines with him and acts as a mediator in the negotiations for a peace treaty, in which Jean ultimately agrees to pay Edward 4 million crowns for his release and recognises his claims to Isabella's dower counties of Ponthieu and Montreuil, as well as Gascony, Guienne and Calais.
Banging.
And of course, for 3 years, she is in effect the ruler of England.
Yeah, really good.
I mean, the regency proves unpopular, but it is still remarkable that it happens at all. She has to steer the country through, you know, removing the Despensers, overthrowing Edward II, establishing her son as king, which, you know, constitutionally is quite a tricky thing that's not actually been done before.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's not just a... it's trickier than it would be a foreign power in many ways, because you're sort of doing it under the pretense of this all being for everyone's good. It's sort of legal, but it's never happened before. But... And she manages that in such a great way, being so totally blasé, you know, nailing it to the right, to the Eleanor cross and everything.
And it certainly shows the full extent that we've seen before, even with the Saxons, of how powerful queens can be in their role as queen mothers.
Yeah.
And also her most unpopular policy in battliness that we mentioned, which destroys her popularity as regent overnight, was really in the country's best interest with the peace treaty with Scotland. It is a very sensible policy. As much as the nobles hate it, the war in Scotland really can't be won now for England. The military situation has deteriorated so far. England doesn't have the money to keep on fighting indefinitely. Isabella's approach is very pragmatic. She thinks it's a futile war. Can't afford to be fighting and getting invaded in the north all the time. Independence, off you go. Done.
Yeah. Definitely the right decision. It was just, I think, people getting... wanting some adventure, certainly her son. Maybe it's a bit like the Crusades, just getting these warring, giving the warring nobles something to do.
So this is still good stuff, but there are negatives. And really, if you think about it, she was a bad queen.
What?
Like, if there's one thing you expect that you ask of a queen consort, it would be not to take a lover and overthrow your husband, the king.
Yeah.
That almost goes without saying in terms of the job description.
Yeah.
Things not to do.
Yes.
And, you know, Eleanor of Provence and Eleanor of Castile, they stuck by their husbands through everything. They're always, absolutely, this is the side that I'm on. Doesn't matter the rightness of the cause against my husband.
She could very easily have been one of those, couldn't she, with her pedigree? Indeed she was. Yeah, she was right up until the point that Edward just became too ruddy Edward.
However, unfortunately for her, which I think is one where she really does fall down, her record as regent is not impressive. She was notorious for her acquisitiveness once she gained power. So after Edward III's coronation, she awarded herself estates so vast that she was now the greatest landowner in the country. She went on to accumulate a vast personal wealth, most notoriously the £20,000 that the Scots paid for their independence all goes straight into Isabella's coffers.
Ooh. So, just resting in the account?
So not only do the nobles have to put up with this peace treaty, which they really, really hate, but the financial compensation for it has all just gone to her.
Yeah. I mean, she's doing other stuff, though. She's sorting the country out. That's a little... put that in my back pocket. I've got expenses.
And this is the thing, her sort of sense of entitlement as a princess, as queen, etc., etc., was a key to, I guess, her, you know, having the motivation to break with Edward II. But once in power, it obviously brings out a less good side. And for many people, they thought, well, this is just as bad as it was under Edward and the Despensers.
Yeah, that's her biggest fault, I think, on subjectivity, that she just saved the country from a problem and just did exactly the same thing.
Mm. Although the invasion was largely a bloodless coup, it did see some serious unrest break out in the country, particularly in London, where the Bishop of Exeter was dragged from his horse, taken to Cheapside, and had his head hacked off with a bread knife.
Why? What's he been up to?
Well, he was part of the Despenser clan. Oh. Well, not the family, but he was part of that regime. Very high up, very prominent. She sponsored a statute once everything had been sorted out and she was actually in control to address endemic lawlessness in the country. But within 6 months, there are numerous complaints of these not being properly enforced, and there's a sense that Isabella doesn't really fully have control of what's going on.
Mm, right. Of London or the country, did you say?
Generally, there's a lot of lawlessness, generally. Mm. And she is not above a bit of brutal violence herself. When Hugh Despenser the Younger is captured, she planned to have him executed in London for maximum publicity, but he was aware of this and tried to starve himself to death, so she settled for executing him at Hereford instead. So he was roped to four horses and dragged through the town to the castle walls, and then hoisted onto a specially made gallows 50 feet high, so that everybody can see at the back, with a fire burning beneath.
Why? Stop people climbing out to rescue him?
Well, perhaps, and also just to make him a bit more uncomfortable. An executioner scales a ladder, because it's 50 feet high, to hack off his genitals, which he then drops into the fire. Still alive at this point. Before bringing him back down to be drawn and quartered.
Right. That's terrifying, isn't it?
Many have suggested the castration is because Isabella believed there was some kind of sexual relationship between Hugh and her husband, but certainly quite personal. And finally, you've got to ask what her end game is in all of this. Edward III, as I said, he's 15 when the invasion happened, so although he's not at his majority yet, he's pretty close to it, and yet she and Mortimer are acting as if they're just going to carry on running the country indefinitely. You've got Mortimer acting with regality, raising the question that people did raise, is he trying to make himself king? And you think, well, what is Isabella doing here? What does she think is going to happen? What's her plan? What's going on here? Is she just completely given over to whatever Mortimer's doing? Is she putting Edward in danger? Ultimately, Edward, her son, is so disenchanted and concerned that he launches a coup against his own mother, which is hardly a ringing endorsement of her record.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. So he definitely wasn't informed of any imminent handover.
Mm.
That's tricky, isn't it?
And unsurprisingly, she is something of a notorious figure in English history. The contemporary chronicler Geoffrey Le Baker described her as that harridan, that virago, that Jezebel. Whilst the Victorian historian of the consorts, Agnes Strickland, wrote, "No queen of England has left so dark a stain on the annals of female royalty as Isabella, the only instance of a queen of England acting in open and shameless violation of the duties of her high vocation, allying herself with traitors and foreign agitators against her king and husband, and staining her name with the combined crimes of treason, adultery, murder, and regicide."
I mean, it's all true. It's regicide stuff, but I mean,
she's popularly known as the She-Wolf of France, which is said in the first episode. It's quite a corny name. It's actually a phrase first used by Shakespeare in relation to Henry VI's consort, Margaret of Anjou, but an 18th century poem by Thomas Gray attributed it for Isabella, and it's since become her epithet.
Oh, yeah, but that's quite cool, isn't it? The She-Wolf.
I mean, it is cool.
But I would just take away the she, would be a better.
The wolf. It's not
like if you were a king, you wouldn't say the he-wolf. The He-Wolf of Hanover. I don't know how much to dock her, how many points to dock her, because I think if without that regency bit, it'd be a big fat 10.
I think this is the problem. If she's overthrown Edward, and then she solves all of the problem, all of the iniquities, all of the sort of tyrannies of the Despensers, she rules well, she brings the nobles back together, and then she hands power over to Edward, and that is the beginning of this golden age that Edward institutes.
Mm.
Whereas instead, she's just like, this is really awful, the way that these guys are just completely taking all of the money and bullying everybody and running the country really badly to their own ends. I want to be the person that's doing all of that stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
So she kind of just replaces them like for like, rather than actually improving matters all that much. I mean, you've got the peace with France and Scotland, etc., but it's not a popular regime. It doesn't seem that much better than what went before. And the fact that her own son has to overthrow her.
Yeah. I don't... In talking up the bad bits, I don't feel much confidence in doing it because I feel like it's taking away too much. But like the bits where she was going, she was bred to be a queen. Effectively, she was when she got the chance to actually not just do it as a consort, but actually as regent. That was never part of the training.
Mm.
But on the other hand, her actions do allow for Edward to come in.
Technically, just sitting back and letting time take care of itself would ultimately have let Edward back in as well.
Yeah. I want to give her a big fat 10, but I know I can't. So I'm trying to tone down the negatives.
I think there is like good stuff, and it's one of those, I suppose, subjectivity. Would you want her to be your queen? I say, well, suppose yes, in the sense if you could just take what she's got to offer and put her in a sort of conventional position as queen consort. They said, yes, I think she'd be very good. She's, you know, she's cultured, she's shows some kindness, she's got the diplomacy with France, which is good, intercedes in the nobles, that's all very good. But I think you do have to take into account the actual stuff that happens as well as just the things that she's good for. And, you know,
yeah. It's not just a manifesto. You actually have to do it in power.
It is scandalous to overthrow the King of England. And that's why it's really good for battleness and scandal. But it's difficult to then get a good subjectivity score on the basis of why you've got the other two being good. So I think that's where she, to get a good subjectivity score, needed to be a really good regent. You really needed to feel like, yes, this is the dawn of a new era. She solved all those problems. Everything's so much better. And now here comes the great young
son
king lead us to the rainbow, whereas instead you're like, oh, it's still kind of as bad as it was before. It's just that now you're making all the money instead of the dispensers.
Is there an argument to say, though, that we're judging her as a queen consort, and the time when she was a queen consort, it was good?
But again, if we're judging her as a queen consort, she is not meant to commit adultery and regicide.
Yeah.
That's not...
So there's points coming off somewhere, and we're just deciding which factor it should have come off. But to what extent they come off, I'm still... like, maybe an 8.
An 8?
Yeah. I don't believe she would have kept the throne from Edward. I think Edward maybe jumped the gun a bit, and he quite liked that. You know, he was prone to a bit of adventure.
But what's Mortimer up to? You know, what Isabella's doing, but, you know, what's Mortimer planning? He's going around in tournaments, taking precedence over Edward III. He's dressing himself up as King Arthur. Edward writes to the Pope at one point with, like, a secret code for how the Pope knows whether or not Edward is really the author of things that are being done.
Yeah, that is bad. That is jolly bad, and that is bad, bad, Mortimer bad.
But all the things we credit Isabella for, where we're saying, well, but maybe Mortimer was in charge, maybe Mortimer was doing it, we say, yeah, but Isabella's the one that's actually in the lead.
Yeah, that's true.
So we can't then, when there is some bad stuff, say, ah, oh, but that was all Mortimer. She was just there thinking, oh, I'm sure it'll be fine.
That is possible, though, isn't it? It is possible that it was all Isabella good stuff, all him bad stuff. Unlikely. Well, I'll take it down to 7, but I'm not going any further because I really do like her. And I think that subjectivity-wise, you would want her as a consort. Yes, she mucked it up as regent, but that was never her. That wasn't the job she applied for.
Well, I'm quite a bit low, so this is going to be one of our biggest gaps, I think. I think ultimately, it's not good subjectivity. I think the overthrowing, the bit of the chaos that comes, the acquisitiveness, the fact that Edward ultimately has to overthrow her.
I mean, it sounds bad when you say it like that.
I think that leads me more to the negative side than the positive. So I'm going to go. I'm going to go 4
wow.
for subjectivity, because I do agree. I do think that actually, given the right circumstances, she's an excellent queen consort and a better king. Would have been very well served by having her as queen.
Yeah.
But we have that with kings sometimes, where we think, oh, yeah. Vikings hadn't been there, he could have done all of this stuff. And ultimately, I think it has to be what actually happens as well as their attributes. Anyway, so that's a 7 from you, a 4 from me, so that's still 11 out of 20 for subjectivity, which is not bad.
Yeah, higher than you imagined.
Longevity.
So, Isabella is queen consort from the 25th of January 1308 to the 25th of January 1327. Exactly 19 years to the day.
All right, well done.
And she's then also Queen Mother from the 25th of January, 1327, to the 27th of November, 1358. So 31.83 years. Now, you only get half marks for your time as Queen Mother, so that gives her 15.92 years from the Queen Mother period. So add all that together, and she is credited with 34.92 years of queenship, which gives her a score of 16 out of 20.
Another good one.
Ninth best overall. And ironically, of course, she actually sabotages her own score here because overthrowing Edward robbed her of many years of full queenship.
Yeah, and she's still got 16.
Dynasty, not the program.
So Isabella has 4 children with Edward II, all of whom survive Edward. So that gives her a score of 14 out of 20, which is joint 16th best overall.
Gosh, she's doing terrifically well.
She is. So Isabella has a total score of 81.
Which is surely top.
Well, Eleanor of Aquitaine got 81.5.
No! So I love it when this happens.
Half a mark off Eleanor's total score.
That's amazing. It's, wow.
Now, interestingly, in the combined spreadsheet, so this is English monarchs, Scottish monarchs and consorts together. So yeah, that's where the longevity and dynasty are measured against all of the series rather than just within the series. So you sometimes get a slightly different score. In that, she gets a score of 82, which is actually the same as Eleanor of Aquitaine.
That's like winning on goal difference.
Yeah.
When you drill down into the data that one level further.
Yeah.
That's, I like that. Both same points, but then wins on away goals or something.
Mm. Anyway, that is a spectacular score. It's the second highest for the consorts, and it's the joint second highest ever, ironically, with the person that's higher than her in the consort series, but that's all the maths. But it's not all about the score. Does she have that certain something, that lasting legacy, the great achievement, the star quality that we call...
Rex Factor!
Shall we not muck around here? It's definite, isn't it?
I really can't think of an argument against her here. It's as about as Rexy as it can possibly get.
Yeah, it's just Rex Factor. She's got all the heritage for it. Wow. Yeah. Really good.
It's amazing. You know, she overthrows her husband, all of this amazing stuff that she does. She rules effectively in her own right for a number of years, admittedly not necessarily terribly well, but it's amazing that she does it. And it's the fact that she's rejected isn't because she's a woman, it's because people think she's ruled badly. Mm. Or she has unpopular policies.
Yeah, yeah.
So she is accepted as the leader.
It's brilliant. Absolutely brilliant.
And that is 2 yeses, which means Isabella has got the Rex Factor. Well done, Isabella.
Couldn't not.
Indeed. That is actually the first Rex Factor since Eleanor of Aquitaine.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, well, I'm jolly impressed.
Correspondence Corner.
Anyway, that was the life and consortship of Isabella of France. Let us know what you thought about her. I guess the subjectivity is the interesting one, because I imagine most people would agree that she deserves a Rex Factor, but do you think she deserves a high score for subjectivity or a low score?
Yeah, that's where I can imagine the only possible disagreement could come in.
Mm. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can find us on Twitter and Instagram, where we are at Rex Factor Pod. Like the Rex Factor Podcast Facebook page or email rexfactorpodcast@hotmail.com. And remember to send in your hashtag consort cars for episode images for all of our consorts. And we'd love to see an Isabella of France consort card.
Yes.
So that's with the widow's veil on a horse with Dunstan's ring and War Pigs by Black Sabbath blasting out.
On an electrified lute. I mean, we've done the heavy lifting for you there. We just need someone with the skill.
If you'd like to support the podcast, you can leave a review and subscribe on whatever podcast provider you use. And donate monthly to join the Privy Council and get lots of bonus episodes at www.patreon.com/RexFactor. And we've got new Privy Councillors to welcome to the fold, or they were new some months ago. L.A. Markey, Becky Love, Maleve Bold, Will Turl, A. Jack, G. Ford, Ashton Adams, Tim and Laura, Charlotte Kirkman, James Lavender, A. Wayhill, Loris R.F., Eamon O'Reilly, Toby Morris, Taylor Kniffer, Brandon Bender, Ditty G.H., Jen Barkley, Lord Montgomery Sideways Butterscotch, Joe Freighter, Catherine Price, and Christy Phillips.
Well, welcome, one and all. Take your rightful place in the Privy Chamber.
And that's Brandon, of course, who we did the Ethelred the Ready interview with.
Oh, yeah.
That kickstarted our doing interviews thing.
Yeah.
It's a nice being part of the Privy Council, as he has been for some time. So that's all from us and Isabella of France. We'll be back next time with Philippa of Hainaut, consort to Edward III.
Oh, yeah, we Hainaut that thing, yeah.
There it comes in.
So clever this time.
See you next time.
Cheerio.